I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Coming up in today's show, we bring you three conversations about the Underground Railroad. We'll hear about the woman who started it, Harriet Tubman, with Tubman biographer Catherine Clinton. We'll also explore some different takes on the slave freeing network. We'll hear from the co-creators of the play The Underground Railroad Game, Jennifer Kidwell and Scott Shepard. And we'll hear from author Colson Whitehead, whose new novel, The Underground Railroad, is a clever and brutal reimagining of the escape route from slavery. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us today. We're bringing you three conversations about the Underground Railroad. Despite its misleading moniker, this pathway to freedom did not involve a secret railroad. Yet it's easy to understand why school kids imagine a real train with a real conductor setting off on real tracks in an underground tunnel. So author Colson Whitehead went ahead and wrote an account of just this in his new novel called The Underground Railroad. Mary Cummings Jordan spoke to Colson earlier this week. Let's take a listen to a portion of that conversation.
So the enslaved woman, Cora, in The Underground Railroad is your protagonist. Tell us more about her. Who is she?
Sure. She's 16 or 17. She doesn't actually know. Slave masters didn't keep track of their property's ages. In the same way, you might have a dog named Fido and know that he is 7 years old. You might not know he was born on August 31st. And so she could be 16, 17. And her mother's run away a couple years before. So in the language of the plantation, she's a stray with no family, no one to take care of her. She's been fending for herself for many years. And then one day, Caesar, a new arrival to the plantation, brings up the idea of the Underground Railroad. He has suffered an unfortunate calamity. He was raised on a small farm in Virginia and had been told his whole life that he would be sold once his master died. His master didn't leave a will, and so he and his parents were sold with the furniture and the buggy and all of his owner's stuff down south. And, you know, with each state you go more and more south, the worse slavery gets. So he is quite surprised when he comes to the plantation where Cora is.
This is not the Underground Railroad of the history books here in America. So, first of all, why did you decide for this book to reimagine the structure of the Underground Railroad?
Yeah, I came up with the idea 16 years ago. And at that time, I usually started a book with a strange what-if premise. And so my first book, The Intuitionist, started from, what if an elevator inspector had to solve a criminal case? John Henry Day's about the folklore hero was, how do we, you know, what if we updated this industrial age anxiety myth of John Henry for the information age? And so, whereas my last couple of books have been more character oriented, back then I liked the problem of the what if. And so I was sitting on my couch, came across a reference to the railroad, and remembered how in fourth grade when I first heard about it, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, heard the words Underground Railroad, and they're so evocative, and envisioned a network under America. It's not very practical, and I'm sure my teacher told me how it actually worked. It was more of a social network. But that day I thought, oh, what if it actually was a literal tunnel? What kind of story could you get out of that? And then fleshing it out, I added another complicating element, which is that every state our protagonist goes through, South Carolina, North Carolina, is a different state of American possibility, an alternative America, what might have been or what could be, sort of like Gulliver's Travels, as, you know, Gulliver goes from island to island, interacting with different parts of British history and culture. So would our protagonist find a different America each time she emerged from the tunnel?
Yeah. So, and as far as the Underground Railroad is concerned, it's a thread that runs through the story, but we never really find out who built it and how. You didn't get into too much detail with that.
I could have spent 10 pages on describing the tunnel. It's not what the story is about. It's about these different islands of American experience that Cora finds on her journey journey north.
Well, there's little relief from the nightmare of slavery for Cora. The first stop for her is South Carolina on the Underground Railroad. And the white man who meets them, Sam, says to her, "You're a long way from Georgia. South Carolina has a much more enlightened attitude toward colored advancement than the rest of the South." And we soon find out this isn't so. The seemingly inviting medical center that Cora visits.
Sure. I mean, I think I don't write historical novels. I'm not going to get kicked out of a historical novel writing union. And so once you make a literal tunnel, you pretty much departed from reality. And so that allowed me to have a larger conversation with American history and place different events in friction with each other to see what came up. And I guess after I had this very realistic first section in Georgia on the plantation, I felt free to play with things. And my rule was, I'm not going to stick to the facts, but I'll stick to the larger truth of things. And so, again, ahistorical, but in my South Carolina, this alternative South Carolina, the government, benevolent, has bought slaves from their masters and freed them and given them housing and jobs and education. And by not sticking to the facts, I can sort of play around with progressive social programs, you know, from the 1960s, a Great Society, and see how they would have played out with a slave population.
Did you find then when you were writing this that you needed to step away from some of this stuff, the research that you were doing and then extrapolating it into the story?
Well, the hardest part was doing the research and then realizing what I'd have to put Cora through just to be realistic. While I do alter history, you know, once she gets to South Carolina, I want that first section to be as realistic as possible, if only to honor, you know, my nameless family and ancestors who went through the system. You know, I don't know much of a lot of my family before 1900.
Is it something that you like to know and that you feel you'll actively search out at some point?
I actually had no curiosity afterwards. But, you know, I've said, you know, I know that my mother's grandmother came from a line of free men and free women who owned taverns in Virginia. I guess I had a cousin who had done the whole family lineage and was like, well, actually, it goes back even further than that, and sort of corrected me so I can stop giving the wrong information in interviews. But, you know, that's one line. And I have grandparents who came out of Florida and Virginia. And where were they? Did their parents live in Louisiana that they're sort of lost in the – or Georgia or Florida, they're lost in the sort of black hole of slavery. So I want to be realistic, and it is hard. It is difficult material to read, to write, and contemplate. It was also a reality. For me, once I started the book, I sort of had the necessary distance and engagement. You know, you have to be in it with the characters to make them real, but also a part to shape the material in an artistic way. And I found that balance fairly quickly. And my office is in the basement, and so I'm always down there. And then I can always come up to the light and make dinner for my family and hang out with them come 3 p.m. So work was very separate for me.
Well, you have. We were talking outside before the show began, and you have two small children. And so do you want their youngest children? So down the road, if they want to read this book, how is dad, you know, would you walk them through it? Because there's tough stuff in here.
Well, my daughter's very sweet, and she's 11, and was excited about the attention the book was getting. And for the first time, I was like, oh, I'm going to read it. And she got 5 pages in, and didn't mention it again, which is fine.
She's a little young.
So she'll come to it, you know, or not in time. I'm not going to push it on her. I have some more lighthearted books she can start with. You know.
As difficult as this book is to read at times, there is a sense of optimism regarding Cora toward the end of the story. And I won't spill anything here, but why did you decide to take the story there?
Well, you have to, I mean, in order to run away from the plantation, you have to have some optimism, some idea of hope that there's a place where you can be free. Even if you know, have never left a plantation, I have no idea what being free is. And of course, Cora, as she goes from state to state, has a shifting idea of what it would actually mean to be totally free of the plantation. And you know, my last novel was about the apocalypse and survivors coming together.
Zone one.
Yeah. And they're both animated by the same, human hope, that there is a place of refuge beyond the next ridge, where the last human survivors, there's a community of people who will take you in and protect you from the world. And so there's that kind of overlap there. And so a slave without hope stays on a plantation. And so that's, you know, I think essential to anyone who, the story of anyone who escapes, and definitely for Cora.
It's been over 150 years since the Emancipation Proclamation. And over the last few years, of course, there's been a lot of unrest, particularly stemming from the killings of black men by police. Stop and frisk, of course, once again in the political discourse. Why do you think we're still in this place in this country?
Well, we don't do anything, you know, about police brutality. I mean, I think Ridgway starts as a slave patroller. Slave patrollers 200 years ago were the police force in the South. They could go into any plantation, any free black's house, demand to see their papers, rough them up, in a, you know, direct echo of, you know, the way sort of corrupt law enforcement works today. And we don't fix it. We talk about it. So people have said, you know, has Ferguson inspired the book?
I was wondering if this book came at a particular time.
In my point of view, Ferguson is a blip. You know, we talk about these things every couple of years when there's a big event, and then we go on to something else. Growing up in New York in the 80s, where you had people like Michael Griffiths being killed in a chokehold by cops, Eleanor Bumpers, a mentally disturbed woman, killed by emergency responders. The stuff that Black Lives Matter is talking about isn't news to me or really, you know, any sort of black American. If the book came out 5 years from now, you wouldn't have that you wouldn't be thinking about Ferguson because our American amnesia would have kicked in again.
The civil rights icon, Congressman John Lewis, was in Philly not too long ago. He received the Liberty Medal, I think it was just last week. And in his acceptance speech, he said, "There are some people that have said nothing has changed. Come walk in my shoes and I will show you change." And of course, Lewis helped to lead the 1965 march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. What is he referring to, do you think? Can we take a sense of hope from his words?
No, sure. And I do. And we do make progress, and it's just very slow progress. I mean, I think we're very sort of dim-witted sort of people. And it takes
a while.
In
general, the American.
It takes a while for things to sink
in.
That's
just a human existence.
Yeah. You know, I think back to, you know, people who actually do think that the Underground Railroad was a real thing. And there are people out there, and I'm telling you that, it was not a literal set of tracks underground. And I think that's a failure of, you know, some teacher along the way and the educational system. And growing up, I definitely would learn about slavery, the first top of the hour, and then Lincoln. And that was like my 1 hour on slavery in fourth grade. And then you hear about separate but equal, and then Martin Luther King, and that's your second hour on race in America in sixth grade.
Well, is that changing for your daughter? I mean, about fifth grade now?
Sure. I think they're catching up. And, you know, we are making progress. But Lincoln doesn't end racism. And Martin Luther King marching on Washington and our first African-American president doesn't usher us into a post-racial future. But it is progress. And I think that's what that quote from John Lewis you brought up as addressing.
Yeah, well, that and on to Barack Obama. I don't know what your political affiliation is, but regardless, you know, in your opinion, what was the perceived promise in Mr. Obama's election to the White House, and has that promise been fulfilled?
I think we're going to miss him immensely. You know, so sort of my takeaway from the last couple of years, the last couple of months watching the campaign. There was a sort of impossible promise heaped upon him. You know, you can't undo 300 years of racial unrest with one swearing-in ceremony. But I think what he has achieved will ripple out, you know, for decades. And definitely for my daughter, it's not weird that there's a black president. And who knows, a few months from now, it might not be weird that we have a female president.
That was Mary Cummings Jordan's interview with author Colson Whitehead about his new book, The Underground Railroad, recorded earlier this week. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about another unique take on the Underground Railroad from two alternative theater playwrights. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Underground Railroad-themed edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Slavery is an integral part of any history curriculum in the United States. It's been called our original sin. Teachers have to come up with creative and engaging ways to convey the history of slavery and the Civil War. One such method had a profound impact on playwright and performer Scott Shepard, who used his fifth-grade exercise called the Underground Railroad Game as the basis for a play of the same name. I spoke with Shepard and the play's co-creator and co-star Jennifer Kidwell about the play's origin, their creative process, and how to approach a comedy about something as disturbing as slavery. They performed it at last year's Philadelphia Fringe Festival. Let's listen. So take us back to your fifth grade class. This was a real, what, lesson in this, the history of the Civil War?
Yeah, right. So in my fifth grade class, we had this unit. It was the Civil War unit. And because we live in Hanover, which is only a few miles east of Gettysburg, there's a big reenactment culture, a lot of Civil War buffs, and they are they romanticize the Civil War a lot. And so we had a group of fifth grade teachers that were very excited about teaching us everything they knew. So we had this interactive unit where we were split into Confederates and Union soldiers, and we competed, you know, doing different school activities to accrue points for our different teams. So like the spelling bee, Civil War songs, marching competitions, you could earn points by doing these different activities. And then at the end of the war, you would win or lose the war. And that was how you kind of learned about the Civil War.
Well, reaffirm or rewrite history.
Right? That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the games was the Underground Railroad game. And so in this game, we had boxes labeled safe house, and the Union soldiers had to sneak the slaves from box to box, and the teachers would kind of mark their progress, and you could earn points by, you know, marching them towards Canada, which was the last box. And the Confederate soldiers had to capture these slaves. So if they were, you know, out and about, if they were visible, if they weren't in a safe house, the Confederate students could capture them and go to get a police officer, which were the teachers. Mm. And then the dolls were put in a display case, which was jail.
And in your fifth grade history class, who won that war? Was it the North or the South?
My year was the Union, but it depends. It goes both ways. It just depends. They don't do the game anymore, but they did it for a while. And they, you know, I think about 7 years ago was the last time they did the unit.
And why did this stay with you?
At the time, it was one of the most fun moments in school. I mean, it was this live action role-playing game. And we were, you know, coming up with all these schemes. We were putting slaves in our, you know, backpacks and sneaking around. And that was, like, really fun. But in retrospect, obviously, there's just it's so complicated. And it just makes you think about all of the different ways in which we, you know, continue to objectify the black body, or the ways in which we tell stories. You know, history is still written by a certain group of people, you know, the people with the power and the people who with the privilege.
So I'm curious, Jen, I'm assuming that Scott came to you and said, look, there was this crazy thing that happened in fifth grade, and perhaps we could turn this into something for the Philadelphia Fringe Festival? Or some version of that, maybe?
Yeah. We were just hanging out one night with some friends, and he told this story. And it was, like, pretty late, you know. And he tells this story, and I was just like, what happened? And I was cracking up. I was like, that is the craziest thing I've ever heard. I thought one of the craziest things I've ever heard in my entire life. Just bizarre. And I went to a school, I mean, I was schooled in Baltimore, and I went to school with a lot of Civil War buffs, and, you know, there was a lot of, like, a deep commitment to, you know, like, the struggle and complexities, and but we didn't play this game.
Yeah.
So actually Scott was going to make a solo piece originally, and then Scott and I had been assigned... We were to be assigned a duet, so we went to school together at the Pig Iron School at APT. And we were supposed to create a duet in our dance class. But I had to miss some school, so we missed that assignment. And so Scott said, well, instead of – and I said, can we do the assignment and we make it up? And he was like, well, instead of making the dance, we tried to make a dance, and it was pretty bad.
There's a little dancing in this.
Yeah. That's about as much dancing as Scott and I should be doing together, I think. But he had a,
I
the better
it was
idea.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it was beautifully. It's like it wasn't good. But he had the better idea of creating this piece, and I was like, yeah, let's do that.
So a piece which I saw on Friday night, something like this. So how does that start when you start to put something together? I mean, obviously this is based on an experience you had in fifth grade. And then it gets turned into something that people then come to see. Is it a matter of kind of role playing, of kind of free associating as you put this together?
Yeah, but I think that things really started coming together. So we actually went to, I don't know if we're going to get in trouble for saying this on the radio, but we went to this talk at the National Portrait Gallery here in Philly.
Yeah.
And there was a park ranger there who was giving a talk about slavery. And it was such a bizarre day. It was like, it was a weekday. It was rainy.
It was a white guy.
He was a white man. It was a rainy weekday, and there were about seven people listening to this talk about the Underground Railroad at the National Portrait Gallery. It's like one of these things that, like, you know, the Park Service will do that tend to be underattended. And he was clearly very knowledgeable about the subject, but it was so awkward. He was having so much trouble talking, just finding the language around
very
slavery.
Yeah.
You know, like, he was like, I don't know. He couldn't say
like
black people
right.
or African American. He was.
So he said all of them.
Yeah. It was like the formerly enslaved people who were
looking for the correct language.
And it was every time he's given a talk about the Underground Railroad, you know, that word is going to come up a lot. And every time it was a problem for him. And he's like contending with all of these historical facts that he's trying. He seems to care a lot about. But then the awkwardness of how to say. And one of my favorite moments is when he was like, and you know, and slavery is bad. I mean, it was just terrible, really, really terrible. And you know, you're like listening to somebody talk and like kind of feeling empathetic about like how difficult it is, and it is difficult and it is complex. But at the same time, you're like, honey, it's a lot hard. Slavery is a lot harder than you talking about it. So spit it out.
Just
you know,
say it.
Like, what do you mean? It's just like he's having so much trouble. And I'm like, dude, nobody's making you work for free. You're getting paid for this. So, like, let's keep it moving. But Scott and I had a pretty good time at that talk. And
we thought, this is something we can use as
right.
we.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this is the entryway.
Well, what I thought, and as I said, the audience is this fifth grade class. But both of you have the kind of teacher voices. I mean, the ways of addressing the class, either with kind of intention and enthusiasm and focus and a smile. I'm looking at you, Jen.
Well, because Scott's got like a natural teacher presence. Like, everybody together, we all want to do this together. He's got an amazing facility with that. I think, I'm a little less. We're both former teachers, actually.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I used to teach adults. And
I used to teach at Friends Central School out on the main line.
So you know how to, that teacher voice.
Yep.
It's natural.
It comes naturally.
I taught in high school, though. So I had, middle school is a very specific kind of, forgive me for saying this, middle school teachers, but there's a specific kind of saccharine, powerful, energetic camp counselor vibe that you have to really
Trying to cut through all those hormones. Just to, like,
that's right.
It's not easy.
More power to you. Yeah, yeah, it's a difficult.
Well, early on, you ask all the audience, you tell the audience, you know, look under your chair. You're either going to be, you know, on the Union side or on the Confederacy side. And I was thinking, onto a stage and do something. But, I mean, clearly you are working off and playing with an audience that is both kind of horrified, but also laughing, sometimes a little shocked as well.
Did you feel okay in the audience? Did you feel like
we
took care of you?
I did. I did. As I said, you know, I think when you're hauled on stage, it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah. We tried that in some earlier.
Oh, did you?
We did.
Yes.
When you make theater the way we make it, there, you know, 99% of the material we make is on the cutting room floor. You know, I mean, we've tried lots of different things. And so you know, some of the best stories are never going to be shown. Thank God.
Yeah, maybe they shouldn't be shown.
Well, there is, and I have to say, in part of this play, I mean, you two were teachers. There's clearly some kind of chemistry between the two of you. We see you holding hands and kind of arguing, but also a lot of kissing, dancing, some chemistry there. But it also plays on these racial ideas about interracial relationships and who mm-hmm. expects what from whom, and how do, you know, even if you're in love, do you sort of still see that person as some form of a stereotype? Is mm-hmm. that kind of what you were going for?
Yeah, I think it's that. I think it's also a play about play in a way that, like, I don't know if we're like reaching through to get to like a nugget of truth, or really just trying to like expose mm-hmm. The ways that we tell ourselves that we're supposed to navigate this terrain.
Yeah, one of the things we play with in the show is just rules. I mean, the rules that mm-hmm. we're supposed to follow, and what happens when you break the rules mm-hmm. in public and in private, and what's the difference, and why is there a difference, and how do you have to censor mm-hmm. yourself? What do you have permission to do?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, there are, I think that's these parameters.
I did pull out a little section from the play.
Uh-oh.
They're both eyeing the script with a great deal of trepidation here.
Yeah.
Because
I haven't seen this in weeks.
I know, exactly. Trepidation and also like, what is this?
But it is about, again, this relationship, but also the sort of hostility that's sort of built into the flirtiness, if I can put mm-hmm. it that way. But I'd love to have you just do a little back and forth for our listeners.
When I was in college, you know, all my friends had this, we had this secret competition to see who could sleep with more women from different countries, you know, like different ethnicities. I'm winning.
I love how confident you are.
I love how defiant you are.
I love how shameless you are.
Right back at you, sister.
Can you do this thing for me? I know the world's always putting all this pressure on you, you know, saying you have all the money and you have all the power. But with me, could you just be yourself?
You smell great. Can I smell you? Now that is comfort.
Your hair is so angelic, the way the light hits it. You look like a little pink cherub.
What happens when your hair gets wet? Does water just, like, fall off of it?
I wonder what you're going to be like in the dark. Like, are you going to be my own personal nightlight?
I hear what you're saying, but sometimes it's hard to follow because all I see is just teeth, teeth, teeth.
Because of the contrast. You know, most of the time with white men, I can feel their sphincters just clench up with this fear that if they're not careful, they're going to slip right back into history and start ordering me around, you know, trying to make me clean their house. Not you.
Oh, no, I can imagine you cleaning my house.
Yeah?
Yeah. Or no, better yet, churning butter. Those ample skirts.
I love this. I mean, it was fun to watch you perform this up close. You're right across the table from me. But just to watch the kind of the beats, the rhythms, the slight pauses, the, you know, the little momentary sort of moments of tension.
Mm-hmm. It feels ingrained, actually. It's like kind of ingrained. Yeah. Sometimes we think about this scene, or I think about this scene as like stand-up. Mm-hmm. And I think this kind of got kicked off by this question of hipster racism, like the things that people who, quote, know better, end quote, are allow themselves to say. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I think a lot of people respond to the scene and they're like, I just can't believe what he's saying to you. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I hear this on the street. Like, people, right. We actually had. She told the story about the woman on the street. We can never remember what she said, but Scott and I were walking down the street near City Hall not too long ago, and we like got out of the train, and this woman, a black woman, walked up to us, and she was selling candy, and she approached me about the candy, right. I think, first. She's like, do you want some? You want to buy some candy? And I was like, no, I'm good. And then she looked at him, and she was like, is this your man? And I was like, no. And she goes, oh, yeah? She said something like, I wouldn't mind spreading cheese on that cracker or something like that.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. But, you know, yeah, these things are afloat. And, you know, I've heard, like, all kinds of crazy things.
Philadelphia supplies our script.
Is that true?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of what you heard on the street in Philly.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And, I mean, I think it's important to know the scene that we just read really does – it comes out of a really – meet cute, fun, kind of sweet, romantic scene, and that and there's a kind of a click and it turns, and so you thought you were in one play and then now you're in another, and we're really kind of playing with those assumptions, the you know, the idea that everything's okay and we're having so much fun and they're figuring it out.
Yeah, and I think the implicit rules for that kind of scene, that like there's a safety and the Hollywood product of a meet cute, and you know, like what romance is supposed to look like, and those rules are actually very strict. So, you know, our question was, well, what if we try to like superimpose this idea of hipster racism, where, you know, I'm staring the rules down and you know, making my own with a format that's like so formulaic and so recognizable. And what happens if they clash?
And some people describe that scene as a kind of like a dive into the unconscious or the subconscious of those characters, the things that never get said, just the like fleeting thoughts. What if we took those fleeting thoughts and kind of purified them and intensified them and took a look at them under a microscope?
Mm-hmm. Sort of like that Annie Hall scene when they're talking back and forth.
Yes,
and
yes.
What
yes.
they don't, what they're thinking, but they don't say.
Yeah.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
Because there's so much. I think at the beginning of the scene, like one of my favorite things is when we do the scene, and sometimes people will be like, "Oh," like hearing people like really, really into like this is so sweet and cute.
It's a scene where we mention Sandra. We mentioned Sandra Bullock, so.
Immediately Bullock. It's sweet and cute.
Right. They're like, oh, that's the cue.
Yeah.
that's the cue for me.
Know what scene I'm in. Sandra Bullock was mentioned.
Yeah. And then by the end of the scene, it's, you know, like all of those awes have fallen away and there's just like...
We rip Sandra Bullock apart.
Well, even more
like
than that.
Gasps, I mean, in silence, like, I can't.
And are audiences different for different nights, or can you kind of consistently rely on they're going to do this here, they're going to do that there?
Well, they have different flavor. I feel like there's like the audience theme for the night. Like, we really like the love story, or like, we really like all the bad stuff you do, or we just want to laugh, or like, this isn't funny.
Love those.
All
audience.
Of the above, right? That was my conversation with Scott Shepard and Jennifer Kidwell, co-creators and co-stars of the play The Underground Railroad Game, making its New York debut this week. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about the woman who started the railroad, Harriet Tubman. Stay with us.
I helped a field hand make a run for freedom when my 15th year.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. If it can be said that the Underground Railroad had a conductor, it would be Harriet Tubman. While she has been a much-discussed part of the story of American slavery, biographer and Civil War historian Catherine Clinton's book about Tubman goes deep in detailing the woman, her experiences, and her impact. She joined us back in 2004 to discuss her book, Harriet Tubman, The Road to Freedom. Let's listen.
It's such a heroic story. It's interesting that it has been overlooked for so long. Is that part of why it has been overlooked, do you think?
Well, I think much of it is folkloric, much of it is myth-making. Maybe it's because I decided to stay at home with my two young children, and I left academic teaching about 15 years ago. And when I did that, of course, I started looking at children's books. And in there, I found a wealth of information and interesting stories. I remember the one about the undertaker in Philadelphia, a woman who sneaked slaves out of the city by putting them in coffins, and people would follow as if going to a funeral. So I found all these stories so fascinating. I thought, why can't we incorporate them into our scholarship? And I'm glad to say that really scholars are undertaking this. We're looking at the fact that African Americans and whites banded together. In no city was this effort more important than in Philadelphia.
Mm. Well, I want to get to the Philadelphia story, but let's get to the beginning of Harriet Tubman. She was actually not born
Harriet or Tubman, but born in a part of Maryland.
Right, the Eastern Shore. And for those of you unfamiliar, the Delmarva Peninsula, which has a little tiny slice of Virginia and Maryland and Delaware, is a wonderful region. Only 30 miles away from Harriet's birthplace, Frederick Douglass was born there. Hmm. So you have both Easton and Cambridge, Maryland, the two places that are known for these great freedom fighters, being so close to one another and in proximity. Harriet was born into slavery. We're not sure of the exact birth date. It's something that slaves didn't have their births recorded. There aren't family Bibles that we can recreate their lives. We only can recreate Harriet's story from tales told and some of the white records of her owners. But what we know is that she grew up in a loving family, that her mother, Rit, and her father, Ben, wanted to hold that family together. There are stories of how they fought off what was the most profit-seeking, voracious trade on the Eastern Shore, but the slave trade, mm-hmm. that people would come from the Deep South to buy up slaves and sell them south. Two of her sisters were disappeared, sold away, never to be seen again when she was just a young girl. This deeply affected her. So women were there working in the fields and then giving birth to children, which might be seen as commodities by their owners, sold away from the age of six.
Excuse me, you write, slaveholders treated slave children as commodities and as a means of anchoring adult slaves on the plantation. Owners believed parenthood could reduce the rate of runaways. And you also talk about the fact that between, I guess, the beginning of the 19th century to the middle of the 19th century, the slave population in this country went from 2 million to 3.5 million.
That's right.
Knowing, of course, that the infant mortality rate was really high.
It was a miraculous increase, really. We have to remember that slavery was a hemispheric explosion during this period, and the United States had this fast-growing population. It was the only plantation system that increased by natural increase, because in 1808, the external slave trade shut down. So this became a real trade, a real growth, a real capitalist boom, the trade in slaves. And after the invention of the cotton gin, mm-hmm. the expansion onto the southwestern frontier, these slave owners, these planters, wanted slaves. And they went up to the regions in the Chesapeake and the Carolinas, and they bought them and they sold them out. In the North, of course, there was a movement against slavery, and slavery was being phased out. And Pennsylvania was one of the earliest states to get rid of slavery. But and these free states versus southern states were in great battle. And here was the borderland right here. And Harriet was born into that border. There were lots of free blacks in the Delmarva region. She grew up where Quakers were holding meetings, where these meetings led to the formation of anti-slavery societies. We even had in both Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York during this period, the growth of what were called vigilance committees, because there was such a need for slaves that people were going into cities and kidnapping free blacks. Hmm. They were disappearing. You can read the newspapers of the time and see people were seeking their relatives who were stolen off the streets and sold into slavery. This was a big problem, and African Americans had to fight it. They founded vigilance committees. These vigilance committees led into the Underground Railroad, the clandestine movement to get slaves into a free and safe, secure region.
You had mentioned the fact that several of Harriet Tubman's siblings were sold into slavery, and that
sold away. They
sold
were
away.
In slavery.
Right.
All of them were born into slavery.
And sold away and never seen again.
Disappeared.
How do you know that had an impact on her? Was this something that she talked about later
she
in her life?
She had dreams about it. She was haunted by her dreams. We know that from adolescence onward, she suffered a severe disability. Some have chalked it up to temporal lobe epilepsy, because she suffered a severe injury as a child. She was struck down by a lead weight trying to protect another slave from being punished. So we know that she took this blow to the head. But we also know she had very wild, severe, intense dreams, and they could have been hypnagogic hallucinations which come out of narcolepsy, whatever. Imagine that she had this incredible, remarkable career, and it was all during a period when she suffered from, quote, losing time. Hmm. People would say she would nod off, she would fade away, and yet come back. And people entrusted their lives to her throughout this period. So
you also describe her as sounds like a very determined young child, as much as you're able to glean about her. She didn't like being in a house slave, as she preferred
outdoor work and being with her family. But certainly when you recognize that she was snatched out of her home, taken to a white household for hire, asked to take care of babies after doing domestic labor all day long, if the baby cried in the night, would the mistress go to her child? No, she would take a whip and whip the slave who'd fallen asleep. So Harriet suffered under these mistresses with a lash and wanted to be outdoors, wanted to be not in the smothering suffocation of the household. And she was actually, after this injury and her recovery, she became quite known as quite physical. She was able to hoist barrels onto carts. She was able to fell timber. She worked with her father clearing timber. So we also know that she grew into quite a robust person in her adolescence.
And she was about 5 feet tall.
That's right.
Was that tall for that time or medium for that time?
No, but it's just, to me, working on her, finding everyone talking with such awe. And, of course, you find references in the late 19th century, when she was still alive, to her being an Amazon. And I think her giant stature has to do with the respect and awe people had for her accomplishments. How could this little Black woman accomplished so much? But I think this is the lesson that Harriet brings to people, that she had a loving family, she had her faith, she had belief in herself, she had a determination to be free. And if you combine all those elements, then even if you're born deprived, born with people negating you, she was able to rise up and overcome those. And we look to her childhood for these symbols, and what we find is a loving family and her faith.
Well, and she also makes an important statement later in her life about having to choose between liberty and death. She obviously chose freedom over that. I'm trying to imagine, though, what the risks were for a slave to run away from the plantation and try to get to the North, to get to freedom.
Well, when she ran away in 1849, we know there was a period of fleeing the South during this period. We know that there was an exodus of slaves from Maryland. Hundreds were going away. Property was being lost. Planters were in great disarray, great anger. It's ironic, I think, that I mentioned earlier the free Blacks who were stolen in Philadelphia and smuggled southward. Well, those very same lines where we know that these awful slave-stealing gangs operated were the very same lines that slaves ran away and went northward. So the fugitive movement going northward was one that followed the rivers, that followed the backwoods, that was an area that Harriet was familiar with. But for her to leave her family, her home counties, and she was married. She'd been married for 5 years to a free Black, John Tubman. To leave all of that was really remarkable. But as you point out, it was liberty to her or death. And the death that she didn't want to suffer was the fate her sisters had befallen, because her owner had died, and she knew that she and her family could be sold away, scattered to the four winds of the South, never to be reunited. So she wanted to seize her own freedom.
How would a slave like Harriet Tubman even know about the Underground Railroad?
Well, we think that she was aware. She had other qualities. We know, as I said, she was hired out. She worked timber. But we also know, for example, that when she did run away, she gave one of her quilts to a white woman in the neighborhood. We're unsure whether this was a gift in exchange for information, or because she knew she couldn't take it with her, she was giving it to a friend. So we know that she knew Blacks and whites, free and enslaved, in the community. We also know that this was an area where people were moving into Delaware along routes, heading to Wilmington, where there was an Underground Railroad community there. The Quakers and their extended networks were where we would believe she would have gotten her first knowledge and then been helped northward.
Do we know how long it took Harriet Tubman to escape from this plantation in Maryland to get to Philadelphia?
No, we know very little about her escape. We know it was 1849 because that's what she indicated to people, but it's a great story. And then it was just 2003, last year, that a local historian saw a dumpster outside of a very old antebellum home, and he knew the family was clearing out and they were putting boxes into the dumpster. So he asked if he might look through some of those boxes, found a run of newspapers, the Cambridge Democrat from the 1850s, 1840s, discovered the first copy we have of the runaway ad for Harriet Tubman in September of 1849. So these things are still turning up. I mean, this is the problem we have of evidence when we work in Afro-American studies. We have the issues of, we have oral history, We have records. We have testimony at the time. But do we have the official record, mm-hmm. the official testimony, the official document? So working in African-American studies, you have to balance things, stitch them together. But we do know that when she left, she headed for Philadelphia, which was the liberty. She wanted death or liberty, and she came for liberty in Philadelphia because it was known as the largest city. 1 in 12 residents were black in the 1830s. The slave population had been reduced. It was where the African Meeting House had been established, where Liberty Hall was there. She mm-hmm. could come and see the evidence of blows for freedom, of a collective group trying to work toward freedom. And by that time, America had passed the Fugitive Slave Law, the Bloodhound Law, in September of 1850. And this meant that all fugitives living in the North, even though many had taken new names, you mentioned that she was born Araminta Ross. Well, when she came into freedom, she took a new name, Harriet. She crossed a line. She took a new name. She became a free person. And then rescuing her family was something important to her because she wanted them to taste the same freedom. She wanted her husband to come with her. On her third trip back, she went back to John Tubman and tried to get him to come north and discovered that he had taken a new wife. He'd abandoned her.
Well, and this Fugitive Slave Act made her an illegal, right?
I mean, illegal from the beginning, but even more dangerous. There were bloodhounds, and federal law could come into northern communities. And in the 1850s, you had the public rescue of slaves, attacks upon slaves being wholesale taken out of their beds in the middle of the night. So many Philadelphia, a community of blacks, headed for the Canadian border. After 1850, Harriet took all of the fugitives that she brought north up to Canada. There was an Afro-Canadian community across the border in Ontario. She settled at St. Catharines, but she would make her migration back down to Philadelphia to earn her money, going south to rescue, taking people up to Canada during the winter months, helping to save them. This sort of circle had to do a lot with the fact that on January 1st, which is New Year's Day that we might think of celebrating, was the weeping time for slaves. It was when families were sold apart, when traders would take people into the Deep South.
This is a part of the Harriet Tubman story people might not know, which is that she worked for the Union Army. She worked as a scout. She worked as a spy.
Absolutely. She was behind enemy lines. She led men. On June 2nd, 1863, she took a contingent of 150 Union soldiers, Green, South Carolina volunteers, up the river. Over 750 slaves were liberated from plantations. Plantations burned, stock taken. It was a very successful raid behind enemy lines. She was able to lead them up the river because she'd contacted African Americans who had laid the mines in the river for the Confederates. So she used her spycraft very well, and Union generals were very pleased by what she did. They later wrote letter after letter testifying to her bravery, to her Union service, trying to get her that federal pension,
which
she was denied
so much.
For 30 years it took until she finally got it onto the congressional record. Now, she only got her pension because she was the widow of a Union soldier who she married after the war. He died after a 19-year marriage. She was able to apply for a widow's pension and then get it on the record that it was her war service, her participation with the Union Army, that allowed them to triple the amount that she received.
There must have been such a price on her head. Did people in the South, especially after her many trips to the South?
Well, she was known as Moses. She was known. She was so well known. The soldiers down in the South would tip their hats to her because everyone knew who Moses was. When she spoke in Boston in an abolitionist meeting in 1860, she had to use a pseudonym. She used the name Harriet Garrison, because Garrison was the well-known abolitionist editor. So she was very well-known among people at that time. And when Thomas Wentworth Higginson, the Boston abolitionist, who later led his own African-American regiment in the South, saw her, she said she was one of the greatest women of the age. I mean, I'm able to have a little epigraph at each chapter where everyone knew about her. She was such a great woman. But for her to slip into obscurity. I know that Professor Bloxon knows about her. I know the people, the African-American community, the Christian community has kept her alive. But she deserves her place in the pantheon of American heroes. She was a freedom fighter. She went and endangered herself. She put herself on the line. I mean, the Underground Railroad movement was an early movement for collective action. And the civil rights movement of the 1960s has gotten a lot of attention. And I just want to make sure we understand this earlier movement.
The bloody rainstorms, it was dead men that we read.
That was my 2004 interview with Catherine Clinton about her book Harriet Tubman, Road to Freedom. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Liz Fiedler, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
We'd laid slavery in its grave. Come now and stand around my deathbed, and I will sing some spirit songs. I'm on my way to my greater union. Now my 93 years are gone.